Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Carol Muldaw. She is a poet. She has a new book out. Right now, we're going to go to an interview I recorded a couple of days ago. I'm delighted now to welcome artist Carol Anthony. We are sitting in her studio on a windy Sunday afternoon, and her exhibition, Private Glimpses, is opening this coming Friday, the 28th of May, at the Gerald Peters Gallery here in Santa Fe, and is running through the 3rd of July. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
The show is called Private Glimpses. What does that title mean?
Private Glimpses, for me, is about those recognized moments and carefully crafted intuitions that come to us each day. But it's also taking the time to be still and listening to the daily maintenance of quiet between all the technology that's going on around us.
In a day, for example, like today, what are some of those little glimpses, just as an example?
Well, today it was taking time to move 3 straw bales from the beginning of the driveway with a good friend who lives in my cloister that is made of straw bales, and bringing them to the front of the straw bale walls that are adobe and filled with flowers, and just enjoying the wind. I'm not a crazy fan about the wind, but it's with the dogs, it's with the smells of the new lavender, it's about the new growth of thyme, and it's about dill and the herbs coming into the garden.
And so all of those things, little sensory things, there are smell and sound and taste and all sorts of sensations, those somehow get translated into your paintings.
Yes, I feel with my work, I'm not a plein air painter. Everything I do is in a space that's probably about 12 feet by 8 feet. You could give me a gymnasium and I'd still be in the corner. And everything comes from inside me, but I remember quietly how it is outside in the gardens, on my travels, in my home, in the cloister, what I need to do that needs to be remembered and explained.
So when you travel, you don't actually make the paintings and the artwork while you're traveling?
I used to travel a lot, and I always took my Sennelier little crayons, my Strathmore paper, in a suitcase with my underwear, and a few bits and pieces of presents for dogs and stranded ways in Mexico. But for me, it was very special and important after a 2-day or 3-day reprieve. If I stay at least 10 days in a country, I have to paint. It's becoming familiar with the people there, especially in Tulum, Mexico, where I used to go many, many years with a certain group of friends that painted, drew with me. We had wonderful meals, a few good drinks. We danced. We listened to the quiet, the ocean, and we loved the Mayans. And that all helped me to understand that larger picture show of palm tree, of sand, of sadness, of what America isn't in Mexico, and being true to friendships that loved that beauty there.
How did you end up in New Mexico? You're from the East Coast, from the Northeast.
I had a twin sister, Elaine, who is a brilliant and beautiful artist and mother, and I took care of her for a long time. Then she fell in love again, and I knew that this gentleman would take care of her.
Now, when you say take care of her, she was sick.
Yes, she had cancer. I knew when he came into her life, I knew it was my permission to leave, and I could come finally to the Southwest and build a life here that I had experienced early on with Elaine in the 70s. And she and I used to come here every year for 10 days and stay with a client who gave us permission to be in their house without money, but for a painting and a little wine and song. And it was very special. And I think she might have moved out here if she hadn't married a second time. And she has three beautiful kids, and they were all taken care of. But I used to go back and forth a lot during the 11 years she had cancer and take care of her and form a woman's group around her. And that's a huge part of my life now, is helping people to die. And I helped her to pass on with love and with friendship. It was a gift.
You grew up with your sister in an artistic family, and you're not only a twin, but an identical twin. And I wondered, you know, the way that sometimes children, twins, make up a secret language that only the two of them understand. Did you do that, and did you do that with art? Because you were both artists from the earliest age.
Yes. Let's see. I think I call it a code. We used to look at each other and remember perhaps larger sequences of experience that came out of karma. But we also had that same sense of humor. It's called when you lose it, and it's fabulous humor, and you can't explain why. And it's all about the betweens and that beauty of being that happens between, whether it's a twin sister, a boyfriend, whatever that happens that you just know.
What kind of art did you do and creative stuff did you do as a little kid?
Let's see. My brother used to have Lionel train sets. Elaine and I used to build little tree houses, and those tree houses became important to us because we always knew when our mom was dying, very early on, that if one of us died, we would go into a treehouse stage, a moment of impression that was remembered, because we would say, I'll be in the bed with you, or you be in the bed with me in case you die first or I die second. And we'll always hug each other and know we're always there for each other. So our child was a very sensitive creation of beingness that was very loving, actually, with a lot of humor. My dad would come in. He was in advertising. Mom played a great piano, and my uncle played a great sax. So it was nuts and wonderful. And we never did our homework, but we laughed and cried. There was some drinking, some smoking, and there was just a plain way of understanding each other without the words.
We're talking to artist Carol Anthony. In a lot of your paintings, there are two of something, two beds or two eggs or two trees. Is it too obvious and direct to say that those are twins, the way you're a twin?
That's very sensitive. That's very dear of you to say that. I feel the twosome is definitely perhaps about twins. In my cloister here, which is built of straw bale, everything is in twos. The pears trees, the apple trees, the aspen trees. It's a form of being cloistered into a language I hopefully feel is being lost today with the technology. The twosome is about couples, whether you're a man-woman, a woman-woman, a man-man, two dogs, but I think it originates out of twinness and that beauty that is beyond DNA, about a language that is said between two people that doesn't need to be exhausted by words and familiar cliches.
When you lose, I mean, I can't even imagine having a twin sister. When you lose a twin sister that you've been very close to, that you've worked with, obviously there's tremendous grief. Do you feel like your artwork also changed after she died?
Actually, I feel I grieved a long time, and I grieved on many levels that are hard to explain. Because I saw her as she was dying, I saw myself. It helped me not to be so afraid of death. It helped me to have the courage to organize and help myself be better in me, to maybe help others when they're grieving about when their parents or when their friends are dying. My work became a little more abstract and a lot more about the light and the betweens. It's not so much Monet and Chardin, Bonnard, Vuillard. It isn't so much about that kind of reality that I loved and I was affected by. It's more about that light, that illumination, that feel of landscape within that is larger than what you need to see anymore. It's about illumination of the soul that helps me to organize more. Fewer paintings I paint, but they're better in me.
I know there was a quotation about landscape that you wanted to read. Maybe this would be a good time for that.
This was a poem that I wrote that was one of the poems that I wanted to put on a poster that the opera commissioned me to do last year, but I felt a smaller piece of poem was better for them. I was very honored by that, by the way. But this is the one that explains to me that larger picture show of what we are and what my paintings are. Listen to the land. She is the poem that captures that moment of grace and gossamer that are the wings that help us to fly.
We're talking to artist Carol Anthony. So in some of your paintings at a certain point, you started using poems, quotations, letters, postcards, texts, found objects. And so those things have become both visually, but especially in terms of their content, part of your work.
I was an illustrator in Boston and New York for many, many years. I'm a very abstract, let's see, how would I explain that? It's dimensional, because when I went to Rhode Island School of Design, I was a major in illustration. We were given certain problems to create a certain color palette, a certain kind of humor. We had to deal with editors, we had to deal with writers, and then you come up, hopefully, with something on your own. For me, my life and my idea system isn't about just going into a tiny room to paint. It's all about the larger picture show of feeding dogs, feeding birds, even mowing the grass for a moment that was 4 by 5 inches that was in the back of my house. It's about digging a hole for a plant. It's about helping a dog to die. It's about the larger, I think I've perhaps said that a few times, but creating is not just painting a picture, literally. It's about living. It's about learning how to be in a world that is totally your painting. It's about the way you look each day at a flower, at silence, at a dog who needs help, about cleaning your bedroom, about changing a sheet, about taking time to look at a shadow that's coming across a wall that's downtown early morning on an adobe brick building. That is what is creation. And then if you happen to come home and do a little painting from it, beautiful. But you hold that inside you. I mean, I feel that's one of the reasons I've always had a solitudinal life. I'm not terrific at compromise. And I really have to say, I have to be alone and quiet for hours to know how to organize all the above into something that happens to come out, whether it's a song, a poem, a painting, or a good apple pie.
You use the word cloister a number of times. What does that mean to you? I mean, it has, for some people, a religious connotation, but I'm not sure what it is for you.
For me, a cloister is that beautiful slice of quiet within some walls. That originally the name comes from church and monks and the smell of dill and lilac and doves, and where nuns contemplate and where monks pray. I think that's so beautiful. What I've done with a cloister is have taken that meaning and brought it into 21st century for my way of being. It's about cloistering a thought, a garden, a slice of sweet listening that organizes the dailiness of your life. I have a cloister here. A wonderful friend lives there, and she has created beautiful stone paths. They're gardens, and it was originally to be for my twin sister whenever she would come out and be. But a cloister is where I used to go every time when I used to travel a little more, especially to Europe, where I would always go to a church and a cloister to just sit, think, hopefully listen to the beautiful bells, the singing of the choir somehow in a rehearsal, and smell the flowers, and understand that that was the point of view I needed to learn to expose myself more openly to that particular village I was visiting. So I created that here, and that's where I first began, with a cloistered straw bale house and learning how to build with straw bale and adobe, and being with Athena and Bill Steen. They're wonderful, and I learned how to create from the land walls and a slice of thatched roof. And I'm really old-fashioned. I barely have a toilet, but I don't have any technological aspects in my life, but that's okay. I mean, I love that others do. But my work is really about helping others to take time, like when they see the show, to maybe become still and let go of their busyness and see an inner landscape that might help them to see that sweetness of life that was in the 18th and 19th century, which is what I try to live here on my property.
There's a lot of eggs and nests and pears and other foods and things like that that are potentially very symbolic. Do you think of them as symbols, or what do you think of them when you paint them?
For me, it's all about what we were kind of saying before. It's daily ritual that we all need to take time to attend to look at. It's taking time to see that kinder gesture of living that is quiet and sweet, and letting go of the quickness and the the technological beingness of what we're becoming, but to see and feel close to that original form of signage that is human, that is eating, that is sleeping, that is taking time to hear insideness of us.
And so an egg for you is all about that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. It's about birth. It's about gestation. It's about letting go. It's about cozy. They're symbols that, for me, help me to be better in me.
We're talking to artist Carol Anthony. The word mystery seems to come up quite a bit when people write about your work. What does that mean for you?
For me, mystery isn't games. It isn't gameplay. Mystery is about those secrets that we all need to have that enrich what we can be inside. Mystery is not a game. It isn't about those mysteries that they have in mystery movies or in sad partnerships or even good partnerships. But we need to take time to hear that kind of mystery that is in everything. And it's okay. It's okay to say, gee, I don't know. That we don't need to have an answer to everything. That to say, I don't know, is to have the courage to say it's all right, that everything, absence is great presence. It's almost Buddhist. It's about taking time to also listen to the betweens and learning that that's enough and you don't need answers to everything.
Another word that comes up a lot when you talk about your work is silence. And you've talked about that quite eloquently, but I was wondering also whether music, which I know you love and listen to a lot, somehow plays a role in your art.
Oh, you're so sensitive, yes. And I appreciate that question. I was brought up in a huge musical family. My mother's mother was a concert pianist quietly. My mom always played Chopin's etudes and preludes on the piano while we were doing homework. Dad was crazy, wonderful, and humorous. He would be reciting poetry. We'd all be getting into trouble in the living room. Her sisters were in, what's it called? That wonderful stage where you became actors and actresses. What? Oh, vaudeville, thank you. And they were known as the Carol Sisters. Oh my God, three-part harmony in the living room. It was beautiful. For me, the music that I grew up with was everything from two combinations of extremes, doo-wop, which I love, and classical music. Elaine played the piano, I played the cello, and my brother played a bad violin. Well, I played kind of a bad cello, too. But it was an amazing way that I learned how to not have silence, but the music became the silence, and I still listen to music all the time. That's on the more classical and jazz side. And my uncle played with great orchestras in New York, and he would jam in our house. And we would be dancing and singing. It was nuts. But boy, did I learn how to get loose and happy. And my parents passed on early. But boy, did we have one hell of a childhood. And it was mostly the music and my dad's cartoons and drawings and a lot of humor.
So there was music and there was silence.
I think, again, that's one of the reasons I appreciate the empowerment I feel as I get older. It's a relief, let me tell you. But that's another day's discussion. But for me, learning how to organize mystery and to listen to the quiet and the silence is about taking time to say it's okay that as I get older, I don't have to plan lunch for tomorrow when I say goodbye. That it's okay to hear quiet and look at someone for a while and you don't have to fill it up with words. I hope that my paintings are those words that are the beauty, old-fashioned beauty, that everyone needs to help take time to attend to every day in their life, whether it's the daily maintenance of taking a child to school, taking time to look at him run across the street with his little lunch bag or her little girlfriend, to take time to see a shadow in a beautiful pond that's filled with water. My paintings are about really daily subjects that are landscapes, about that sweetness of being that is every day if you take time to listen.
Carol Anthony is an artist whose work has been collected by many museums, and it's in public and private collections. And this Friday, a show is opening at the Gerald Peters Gallery called Carol Anthony Private Glimpses. It runs from Friday, May 28th until Saturday, July 3rd. For more information, you can contact the Gerald Peters Gallery at 505-954-5716. Carol Anthony, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. And I'm so glad I live out here. It's so magical. Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's very special.
I'm very happy now to welcome poet Carol Moldaw. She will be reading tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. So good to be here.
Your poetry is really good, and it's very, we were talking before we went on the air about what makes for good versus mediocre poetry, and it's a crazy discussion that's very hard to come to any conclusions about. But why don't we start with a poem, and we will you'll read a couple of poems during our conversation.
That sounds good. I'll start with a short poem called Out of the West. Out of the West, unexpected, lyric, a stand of yellow irises rises from the pond muck. Two horses graze the field, one limping from the fire they fled. Matter and spirit meet, love, argue, wherever you rest your eyes, a microscopic midges, horseflies.
Now, this is a book, your new book is called So Late, So Soon, New and Selected Poems. This is one of the new poems.
Yes.
And it seems that the question of matter and spirit is very much alive for you in the new poems.
It is. I think it's been there all along in my work, but it's something I'm thinking about in a more direct way now. And there are a couple of poems, this one and a longer one, and probably other places where I'm really trying to explore the relationship between matter and spirit, because it's what really interests and obsesses me in a way in life and in art.
It's something that it's hard to define. I mean, we know what matter is. It's the stuff that we are and that's all around
right.
us. What is spirit?
Well, that's what's so interesting, is we feel it, but we don't really know it. We can't put our finger on it. And I think the only way we can know it is when it's somehow, comes into matter. And they sort of have a symbiotic relationship in our world. Maybe in other dimensions it's different. But, matter is kind of inert without spirit, and spirit is unembodied without matter.
And then when you get down to an atomic or subatomic level, all matter is not inert at all.
No, it's not. But it's not. And it must have spirit. So, anyway, it's kind of a way of for me to think about the internal and the external, and what gives matter meaning, I guess, is what interests me.
I hope we can get as many poems as possible into our show today, because there's something that comes up over and over, which is that your writing is so very personal, and yet it always speaks to something outside of itself. I don't know if you want to call that objective or what, but is that something that you have to consciously do as a poet? Make sure that you're not just staying within your own personal life, because otherwise who cares?
it's not quite like that for me. I know that the personal or the intimate is where I naturally start. I think we sort of all start wherever our temperaments are most comfortable or obsessed or something. And that's where I start. But I think that in writing a poem and in using language and in the kind of navigation between head and heart that I go through in that process, it doesn't stay in what I would think of as a kind of journal, intimate sphere. It just changes. And that's really when I get most interested, is when, you know, the language or the imagery or the poetic form, it's all, even if it seems intimate, it always seems outside of myself to me.
And it's interesting because it's a process that starts in some place which is personal, and everybody writes in their journals, or a lot of people do, and then it gets into something else. And that transformation has a quality which is a really big deal. I don't know, I mean, people have used the word alchemy to describe that kind of a process. But there must be some moment where you know that you've gone over the hump or turned the corner or whatever the metaphor is.
There is. And that's when I, in a way, stop thinking and I'm just engaged in the writing process. And it's not like a jigsaw puzzle, and it's not like a, you know, scientific experiment. But there, I guess I think of it, there's two metaphors I use when I teach. One is that I have a tuning fork inside my head, and I'm writing to that tuning fork, and I can feel when it's, you know, got that chime, and that's when I know something's occurred, and that's what I'm going with and for. And the other is sometimes a poem to me, when I'm working on it, it feels like a sculpture, and I'm always kind of walking around all sides of it, you know, to look at it from all angles. It's very objective feeling to me, and then I'm sometimes startled by how, you know, intimate it seems.
There's a lot of sculptors have written about the process of doing sculpture, and of course there's two different approaches. One is you have a block and you take stuff away and the thing emerges, and the other is you add stuff to it until the thing takes shape. Is one of those more operative for you?
Well, I'm not sure which one. I mean, I tend to, I'm not a person who writes a ton and a ton. And so I suppose I'm not chipping away in that sense. I tend to write slowly and in little increments. So I suppose it's more like building it up.
We're talking to poet Carol Muldaw. Why don't you read another poem?
All right. This poem is from my first book. And I was tickled recently because it was published years ago, and I recently got an email from a man, I guess he, you know, found me on the internet, who said that he had read it years ago and now he was getting married and he wanted a copy for his fiance for their wedding. So I thought, oh God, these, you know, you think nobody reads poetry and then you discover it's made a difference in somebody's psyche for a long time. So that was a wonderful feeling.
What a beautiful compliment.
I know, it was. It definitely made my day, my month, whatever. Transmarine. An open hull nudging reeds and sand. She kept to herself the pleasure he provoked, the undercurrent dimpling as he stroked, and drifted, slackly moored under his hand. Turning to him, she let him loose the knot, drop the rope, and push his foot against the pier to lift her free. Her muscles tensed. He took her like a sail the wind had caught and guided her until she guided him. And when there were no place that either knew, where sky and sea and shadow echoed blue, they plunged and were knocked back at the world's rim.
Carol Muldaw, there's something that I find fascinating, and it's sort of so obvious that no, you never really talk about it, and that is that sooner or later, all poets write about sexuality, eros, and all of that. And sex and sexuality are such inherent and basic and primal biological things, and yet we have such a need to assign to them or discover in them meaning and metaphor and depth and richness and all of these things. And I sometimes wonder why?
Well, I mean, you have to have meaning in life, right? Or life becomes pretty barren and depressing. And I guess I wonder, you know, you say we assign the meaning to them, which would imply the meaning isn't inherent in
them. Or we discover it.
I would say more that we discover, and I wouldn't say there's one meaning that we discover. I mean, I think there's lots and lots of meanings, and the meaning that you discover that is most pleasing to you or matters the most to you is the one you kind of go back for.
I guess I'm asking because I've been thinking a lot about, how do I say it? A lot of biologists and people who study science are looking at animals, and the line between human beings and all other animals seems to get blurrier and blurrier the more we learn about other animals. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if any other animals assign so much meaning to their sexuality. Everybody else just kind of uses it to reproduce and survive.
Right. Well, isn't it kind of an open question what meaning other animals assign to anything, you know, to life, to death, to their children, or you know, the building their houses? I mean, we assign meaning to all sorts of things. We seem to have a deep need for meaning. And I think poetry, what's so wonderful about poetry is that it's a discovery of both that need and a way of filling that need, you know, through language. You know, I don't know very much about that question of animals, and I know there's a lot of animal languages and signals that go on in language, but for us, I think language is one way we approach meaning, and poetry is one of the, you know, most distilled and kind of purest ways of doing that.
Let's hear another poem.
All right. Well, this one is a poem that is a New Mexico poem, and it's called Bosque del Apache. So it comes out of a visit to the bird sanctuary. Winter, scratchy branches flame upward, stiff as ratted hair. Crows crown the leafless trees, black buds that bloom in unison only to fly. At dawn, the marsh is crowded as a skating rink. Ducks land in squadrons, swim in pairs. Geese honk to be let by. Like them, we're stalled in traffic, caught in a cavalcade circling the one-way 15-mile tour loop, binoculars in every lap. We scout to see what we're missing and end by missing what we're seeing. The sky's too busy and too vast. Lavender-orange masses of clouds lit from below stagily surge and disperse, while from the farthest east, daylight's dark stars flap their wings, assume their shifting constellations, and stream over us, crossing the sky like corps de ballet after corps de ballet, undulant velvet ribbons trailing. Each bird, a basted stitch puckering the sky's pale blue satin smock. Each flock, an intricate design in thread the seamstress forgot to lick and double knot. And so it goes. A V of cranes unravels, rivaling the geese for noise.
Just the beauty of your use of language and syllables is astounding.
Well, thank you. That's to me, poetry is built from its syllables, from the resonance of sound as the syllables accrue, and that is what I love about it, really.
I noticed that in some poems you do use rhyme, but it's not really obvious, and one could miss it if you weren't looking for it.
Well, I like use of rhyme in that way. I like that it might have a resonance and it make the poem seem sonically richer, but that you're not aware of it and it's kind of thumping, it's going to come along at a certain place. Or I use a lot of off-rhyme, slanted rhyme.
What is that?
Well, that would be like rhyming... Well, I might not be using the technically right terms, but like lame and lime, you know,
right.
or same and sane, or vain and, you know, things that where the vowels might be the same and the consonants differ, or rather than, you know, oh, of course now I can't even think of the most, you know, sky and by, you
right.
know, which is a full rhyme. And I also don't always rhyme in a pattern, meaning you can't predict when the rhyme will happen.
Right.
So, and I enjoy that. I think it makes it a subtlety.
It's kind of like you're using a form but very loosely.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, form is an interesting question. I like form, but I'm not crazy about what is considered formal poetry these days.
It's like sonnets.
Yeah, I mean, people write beautiful sonnets, but I think that when the conscious mind is preoccupied with questions of form, then it allows a lot of unconscious things to come out. So it actually can increase the wildness. But I don't like archaism, so I like it to feel contemporary to our world.
We're talking to poet Carol Muldaw. Some of the poems are in memory of a person who died or written for a person who's living. Do you often write to a specific person? Does that affect how you write and how you think about your poetry?
Mostly, I mean, I have, you know, poems to my husband, certainly, and my daughter. And mostly, if somebody's living, I don't write a poem to them. But it does seem when people die, I want to commemorate my feelings for them or something. You know, so I do find that death, you know, when somebody dies, you're much more. They're present to you in a non-physical but deeply internal way, and that is something that is the perfect breeding ground for a poem. So I have found that I noticed that reading through this, you know, when I was putting the book together, that there are a lot of elegies.
There's a beautiful one to a man who died of AIDS.
Thank you. That poem means a lot to me, and I think it was actually the first elegy I wrote. And I wasn't able, and this has been true of a lot of the elegies, not able to write it immediately after his death. I think I wrote quite a bit, and then of notes in a way, and I put it away. And it wasn't until 3 or 4 years after he died that it actually was able to take shape as a poem.
Do you feel like the poems have, you know, here's another metaphor, seeds that are planted and then eventually they grow?
Yes, I do. And I do. And I think it's really important to not push things, you know, to not, what is it called, force blooming?
Right.
I think a lot of poems that never quite work are poems that have been forced. I mean, of my own, in any case.
That's so interesting. And how do you... different. How do you know when you're forcing something versus just working hard?
I think there's a more static quality, a quality that you're kind of running in circles when you're forcing it, or that there's an artificiality. It takes, you don't always know until later.
Yeah.
And then I also think with, you know, experience, you learn.
There was a teacher, a spiritual teacher, whose book I read many years ago, and somebody asked her a question about meditation, and she said that her meditation was to walk in the fields and look at the flowers in nature, and too much sitting still and meditating is like trying to force a flower to bloom before its time.
So very similar. I mean, when I write, sometimes, you know, it's been going well, and suddenly I'm stuck for a word, and I'll just take a shower. And sometimes in the shower or when I get out, you know, that word is there. So maybe that's a similar thing. I also have written some poems from dreams. And I was just thinking when you said that about elegies, there's this very short poem, which is both. It's an elegy for a friend of mine who died from melanoma, actually. So he was youngish. And 3 years after he died, I had a very vivid dream. Should I read that one?
Yeah.
It's called Bone Soup. 3 years, still dead, but alive inside me. In a dream, talking to him on the phone, spooning soup from his bones.
Wow.
That was quite a dream.
Good heavens.
Yeah, so I guess you get nourishment from the people, you know, that you've loved even when they're gone.
Soup being a metaphor for
nourishment, right?
Yeah. When you put together this book so late, so soon, new and selected poems, what was the process like of going through your old work and making these selections and putting them all in different categories and so on?
Right. It was really interesting for me. I had just finished my novel, The Widening, and I was very eager to get back to poems, and I was fortunate to have a writer's residency from the Lannan Foundation in Marfa, Texas. So, and I felt very removed from my poems because I'd been working on this novel. So it was really great for me to go through my previous books and, you know, think what do I still feel proud of, what still seems to feel fully vibrant or, you know, fully realized, and what just perhaps was more of a passing fancy or an exercise or a growth or, you know, that kind of thing. And it really helped me get back into the feeling of my own work. And it was really while doing that that I was able to start new poems. And from doing that, I did at first put them in categories like, you know, definitely, maybe, you know, maybe not, definitely not. Or something. No, I forget if I had 3 or 4 or 5 categories. And poems shifted in the categories. You know, you have to look at it more than one afternoon because there's a lot of mood and self-criticism involved as well. But it's wonderful to have because, again, that word distillation, it's, you know, for me, it's, I didn't get to put everything in it that, you know, that I wanted. I would still hope that the single books have, you know, wholeness and resonance. But I was able to sort of get most of what I thought was the finest of my work. And that feels great.
We're talking to poet Carol Moldaw. Every poet is influenced by poets who have gone before. And I was thinking as I was reading your book, there's so many potential influences within one poet. So is it their form, or is it their heart, or is it the subject matter? The poets whom you love and who've influenced you, what is it about them that you feel
and
use?
That's a wonderful, wonderful question. No one's put it quite that way before. You know, I think there's a sensibility that comes through language, a use of language. Sometimes you're influenced by people who are very, very different from you, and other times people you have a great sympathy for. But I think always it's the way they use language opens up worlds inside you, and you think, you know, I want to do something like that. And sometimes it can be very technical, like the way Elizabeth Bishop used rhyme, you know, I think has influenced me a lot in the ways we were talking about before. And some of the people who influenced me, I only know in translation. I mean, like Sappho, you know, just this exquisite, well, for us, it's brevity because so much was lost.
Right.
But the keenness, you know, there. I mean, there have been a lot of influences over the years.
As a poet, do you always write from your own point of view, or do you do what fiction writers do and take on different characters?
I have taken on different characters once in a while. I think it's in this book. There's a poem called The Sorceress that I wrote from the point of view of a sorceress. But, you know, it's kind of that question of a, you know, they say certain actors like Katharine Hepburn or Cary Grant, they play different characters, but they're always playing themselves.
Yeah.
I think sometimes persona poems are similar. The character is a vehicle for something, you know, in you to come out. And I'm not that drawn to persona poems. I think I've done, you know, a few.
We're just about out of time. Let's go out with one poem, your choice.
Oh, okay. Well, I think I'll read The Peony, because actually I think of it as the transmission of poetic lineage. The Peony. A man cups his fingers as if to bring them to his lips to blow me a goodbye kiss, or as if he were Italian to underscore his words. He is not Italian. He is not speaking, and he does not bring his fingers to his lips. Gravely they descend upon a peony held up by the rim of its fishbowl vase. Because I would be his, he tells me a secret it is mine to know, all the while spreading the silky petals with his slowly opening hand, so that the peony is made to bloom to its fullest until it is an open globe overbrimming the vase. Only now do I think of those paper flowers that blossomed when we floated them in water as girls. The words of the secret blurred as soon as I woke, but his light hand gravely forcing the peony, that remains.
Carol Moldaw's new book of poetry is called So Late, So Soon, New and Selected Poems, and she will be reading tonight at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. And my email address is RadioCafe@KSFR.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.